welcome to another episode of Living Downstream, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds. In today's episode, we'll hear from two local artists who feature nature as the subject of much of their work. My name is Ryan, and I am an AmeriCorps member serving in the role of Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for the organization. I want to start this show by recognizing that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was historically occupied by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquel, and Malala, among others. Today we're here with Alva Paulson, who's going to talk with us about nature journaling, wildlife artwork, and the role of art in environmentalism. Welcome, Alva.
Hi, I'm glad to be here, Ryan.
Thank you. To start things off, how long have you done wildlife artwork, and how did you first get involved with nature journaling? You know, was it part of your career or something you did as a hobby?
Okay, that's really a two-part question. The first part, how long? Forever, I think. As a child, art was fun. So that was easy to do. Journaling didn't come until after I got married. And my first journal was very contrived because I always did it after the fact and typed up the words and drew little drawings and was always at least a year behind. And then there's sort of a 5 years I didn't. But in 76, that gives you an idea how old I am, I didn't intentionally start to nature journal. I'd never even heard of nature journaling. It came as a big surprise to me a few years later that there was something called nature journaling, but that's what I was doing. I was actually capturing for my paintings things that I wanted to include into paintings. If I was going to paint a mule deer, was the rabbit rush still blossoming, or what were I sort of have a vocabulary for colors. You know, what were the colors for that beautiful sunset? I could jot it down. I didn't have to paint it in the journal. And my first journal drawings were very much encyclopedic, careful. And it wasn't until a lot later that I loosened up and really started enjoying filling my journal with a lot of behavior. And as far as why did I choose wildlife, I was born into it. Both my parents were research ornithologists, so I grew up with all kinds of wild pets and things like that.
That's awesome. Yeah, it sounds like it's been kind of, like you said, a lifelong trajectory of, you know, getting involved with wildlife and nature journaling and not even realizing you were doing what people now call nature journaling. Yeah, it's interesting to think about how people first get involved with something like that. Do you use or have you used your artwork for activism or advocacy and or educational purposes?
I have. I think of activism being probably a little more, I don't like to use the word aggressive, but I'm a mild person. I like to hook people in gentle ways. I feel very strongly if I can help people fall in love with nature, I will have made great strides in whatever you love, you tend to protect. And so if I can open people's eyes, maybe they'll think a little bit differently next time they need to vote or next time they need to make a donation or next time they threaten to pull out certain plants or plant other plants or, you know, hopefully it brings about some thought.
Yeah, I love the way that art can inspire people and make people think. I don't know. Yeah, I was thinking too I was looking at some of your illustrations of spiders, and spiders do make me a little hesitant. I try to love everything, but I don't know. Yeah, maybe your artwork can help inspire people to think a little bit before they just step on and squish a spider, you know? And I found too, when I'm doing some really close artwork of an animal, that it makes me appreciate it more. You know, I love living beings in general, but I was drawing some sort of aquatic insect recently. And it wasn't something I really knew about, but having to draw it really carefully, that close observation made me realize some of the different nuances and tiny details and complexities of that little creature. So I agree that, you know, when we notice more, and when we start to appreciate then and love someone or something, then we're more likely to protect it. So kind of piggybacking off of that, what do you think is the role of art in environmentalism, and what could it be? So you kind of mentioned this a little bit, but I didn't know if you wanted to explain any more about that.
Well, I think art plays an important role because it's definitely useful in educating people about whether it's trying to protect a wetlands. Well, what is a wetlands? So I know I don't know if the signs are still up or not, but I know Wildlife Safari had some nice signs up describing what a wetlands is. If you go to any of our national wildlife refuges, there's a lot of really good signage helping to explain what's being protected, you know, a little bit about the whole interaction of species. I'm really trying to capture the essence of things. You know, when you read my blog, the spiders were kind of an exception. I talked about several species of spiders, but usually my blog is some natural history event that we've observed. Once in a while, I blog about art or nature journaling, but the vast majority is finding bryozoa or just watching a robin hunt for worms, or it can be very, very ordinary, but hopefully making people look a little harder.
How could listeners learn more about depicting wildlife in their art? So I guess I'm wondering, you know, are there any workshops or classes either that you'd recommend or that you offer? And you mentioned about capturing the essence of something, and I noticed that in your artwork as well. Do you have any tips for capturing the essence of a moving subject in your artwork? Because I know that can be kind of difficult.
Well, let's split that into two, because that's two questions. Good resource, I think, is johnmuirslaw.com. John Muir's Law, are you familiar with him?
I am, yep.
Okay. He has a wonderful website. And if you spend time on that website, you'll find there's workshops, I think, that cost money, workshops that are free. I'm actually currently taking the archived version of their conference. And there's also the Facebook group associated with that called the Nature Journal Club. Basically, I'm not much of a Facebook person. I don't want to spend my life pecking away on a computer, but I do really enjoy that site. And one of the things I love about it is that anybody can join as long as the artwork is appropriate. And they encourage children, and they have some very experienced professionals. It's all across the spectrum and from a whole bunch of countries. And so it's really a lovely place to go to and take a peek at what other people are doing and get some ideas and share.
Yeah, that's great to have such a platform and, you know, community of artists, whether, you know, sounds like beginners or more experienced and of all age levels. Yeah, I'll definitely be happy to share that with our listeners. Yeah, speaking of today's youths, you know, kids today spend so much less time outside than previous generations. What advice or insights would you share with either them or their parents about the value of being in nature?
Well, I really ache for the fact that so many children are never up close and personal with nature. And I feel really fortunate that I grew up very close to nature. When our children were small, we spent a lot of time camping, and before they entered school, they knew all the common trees where we lived. When I had a bluebird group, I don't even know if bluebirds exist any longer, I really enjoyed being able to take the little group of girls out and explore whatever, if it was frogs in the mud, or I've just always really liked it. And I think parents have a responsibility to do that and to share it with them. Don't just let them loose and turn your back. If you're interested, they'll be interested. And I really feel for the kids that don't have parents that have the time or the interest to look at a blade of grass.
Yeah, it's tricky because then that next generation won't be as interested and might not be as keen on protecting the environment that is starting to get so limited in size and scope. Before we go, is there any additional information regarding nature journaling, natural history illustration, and or the role of art and environmentalism that you might like to share with our audience?
Well, I would encourage anybody that has a little bit of a voice inside saying, you know, I think it would be fun to nature journal. my advice is to do it and to allow yourself to make a lot of mistakes. I've seen some beautiful nature journals, and I'm not belittling them. I mean, if a person wants to have each page be a work of art, that's their choice. But I feel very strongly a nature journal should be whatever you want to make it. I call mine a working journal. If I'm sketching in the wild and suddenly my egret leaves and I don't have it finished, I may quit rather than to pretend to finish it. Or I may go home and flip open the laptop and find a photo to finish it. If I'm written a sentence and I suddenly realize there was a better word, I just scratch it out and put a new word in. It's a working journal. I want to capture things in it. I don't want to worry about it being perfect. I keep it personal, but not private. I really like sharing my journal. Journaling can be all about one's emotional turmoil or whatever. That belongs in a different book. And that's where I think it's good to clarify what I mean by nature journaling. It's really capturing nature. And if you allow yourself to make those mistakes, you can start filling pages and be surprised how you'll grow and how much you'll learn.
I feel like that's good advice for life too. You know, not every day, not every moment will be perfect, but trying to make the best of what you can and moving forward. Well, thank you so much, Alva, for being on our show today. And for our listeners, you can check out her blog as well, and I'll share that in our resources section.
You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds. Are you an avid reader? Then you should join Umpqua Watersheds Book Club. Turning Over a New Leaf is a book club for teens and adults who want to learn about and discuss environmental issues and try to make positive change. Umpqua Watersheds has a number of opportunities for the youths in your life. Changemakers is a club for 9 to 12-year-olds who want to change the world. We'll meet on Sundays at 5 p.m. Pacific Time starting January 17th. Do you have a high schooler who loves music, writing, or theater? We're starting a radio club for youths ages 13 to 18 to develop their own radio show. Additionally, we're lending science equipment to local homeschooling and non-homeschooling families as part of our Home Explorer program. If you'd be interested in borrowing a water quality monitoring test kit, microscope, or snap circuits kit, let us know. Email our AmeriCorps member and environmental education and outreach leader at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org, or check out our website or Facebook page for more information. KQUA is a radio station run and maintained by Umpqua Watersheds as an outreach platform to share information for the betterment of our community. Living Downstream is our newest show and will include information and feature interviews on a variety of topics relating to the environment. It was named Living Downstream for two reasons. First, we are all connected by the river, and every one of us needs clean water to survive. Second, the actions we take here today impact others downstream tomorrow, just as we are impacted by those who live upstream from us. Both literally and figuratively, we are all living downstream from the actions of those who went before us. Likewise, future generations live downstream from us. Umpqua Watersheds wants to ensure that the world all our children inherit is a healthy, vibrant, and diverse one. Don't you? To give a little background on our organization, Umpqua Watersheds reorganized in 1995 after a group of eco-minded friends observed an increase in devastating clear cuts of forests and realized the need for a local group to hold the Forest Service and timber industry accountable for their actions. There was, and still is, a need for public oversight of groups whose actions impact all of us and the larger ecosystems we're a part of. And Umpqua Watersheds strives to ensure that the timber industry and others are abiding by the laws in place to protect our water, our land, and our futures, and utilizing the best science available so that all practices done are sustainable for generations to come. The organization was brought to the national stage
when it was discovered that some of the most egregious offenses against the Endangered Species Act were occurring right in our backyard, with destruction of spotted owl habitat. What really helped Umpqua Watersheds get its start, and one aspect that still propels the organization today, is the importance of old-growth or ancient forests and the complex, interconnected, and biodiverse webs of life they contain. Umpqua Watersheds has gone from nonviolent civil disobedience in an effort to protect these precious ecosystems to now also engaging local youths in the importance of the natural world, not as just natural resources for humans to use as we wish and use up, or ecosystem services such as carbon sequestration, nutrient cycling, water purification, and more, which benefit us, but as a complex system containing non-human experience and knowledge that has survived significant events and times yet still endures, but is being destroyed by human hands. There is so much we still don't understand. Would we eliminate that which could teach us? What folly it would be for the student to silence the wise professor simply because his experience differs from hers, or he only wants to take advantage of her for selfish reasons. She, like Mother Earth, has intrinsic value and worth, her own aims and goals not always aligned with those of her student or of mankind. We are quick to tell young people to honor and respect their parents, while dishonoring and disrespecting the mother that still supports and nourishes all of us, and will continue to do so if we let her. What some people misunderstand is that Umpqua Watersheds isn't radically opposing all use or extraction of materials. The Earth does have resources which we need to survive, but no one can argue the fact that clear-cut logging is a harmful practice which is unsustainable and detrimental for all species. Our organization calls for people to do things above board, in compliance with the law, and in a way that is good for the health of us all and the environment. Don't you want clean water to drink and clean air to breathe? Don't you want your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren to have the opportunity to experience the peaceful tranquility of the natural forest, to hear the birds, to smell the flowers? Yes, nature has a level of resilience, but there's a limit to what nature can bounce back from, and humans are making it so that numerous species with which we share this planet are unable to survive. When you try to simplify something that is complex, when you say, oh, trees are renewable because they grow back, you're fudging the math. If you cut down an old-growth forest with 300 or 500-year-old trees, you're not going to get that back in a few years, or even 20 or 50 years. We're harvesting at a rate that can't be maintained, and replacing a complex, biodiverse forest with a stand of replanted, uniformly aged, single species is not an equivalent exchange. The Umpqua Basin is so vital in terms of both carbon sequestration and biodiversity, we all have a responsibility to protect it. In addition to protecting natural wild places so that there's a bright, healthy future for us all, Umpqua Watersheds has expanded its focus to also include education. High-quality education can help our young people be successful throughout their lives, and engaging in STEM, hands-on, real-world integration and application of the subjects science, technology, engineering, and math, provides youths with an opportunity to brainstorm creative and effective solutions to problems. Over the past several years, AmeriCorps members have assisted Umpqua Watersheds in its education and outreach efforts by leading various programs for local youths and supporting local teachers in their implementation of science curriculum. Today we have Susan Applegate, artist and educator, whose family settled in Oregon back in the mid-1800s. We're glad to have you on the show today, Susan.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here, Ryan. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. When did you first know that you wanted to be an artist?
Well, I always attribute it to an experience I had in the third grade. You know, I attended the little country school out here in Yoncalla area in Scotts Valley, where I grew up. And we had teachers that, this one teacher was very unusual. Let me say it like that. Because she gave an assignment to us in the third grade that really opened my imagination. she said, illustrate the story that we've read. And no one had ever asked that of me. And my imagination went wild. And suddenly, all of the things that needed connecting in learning made sense. Once I could illustrate, draw what I was thinking, what was the story about. I could give a visual understanding to that, and it really opened a door to me. And from then on, I always found myself doing art projects in the school setting.
That's awesome. It's so inspiring to have a teacher who, I mean, I was an educator before this, so I always love to hear when teachers can kind of get students thinking in a new way and exploring ways that they can learn. So that's great to hear. Much of your artwork incorporates some aspect of the environment. Why did you choose nature as your subject?
Well, as I've alluded to, I grew up out here in the country. And nature has always been a solace for me, a calming influence, and something that I have associated with the center of myself. So it was always natural that I would go to that when wanting to express something true about myself. I have in the past tried simplifying shapes to almost abstractions, to get some elemental truth about the environment or the landscape. I've tried realism. I've tried all of these different ways to express what I consider some truth about it and about my response to it. I've kept a nature journal where I have faithfully recorded specific plants through scientific illustration, and have painted murals that tell stories and illustrated books.
What do you think is the role of art in environmental conservation and education?
I think that for students to understand phenomenon about the natural world in which they live, art is a mechanism that pushes them to really look, to look, as I used to say when I was teaching, look closely and loosely. So you have to be able to see the shape, and you have to be able to see the intricacies, the designs. And in doing that, in doing the drawings and so on, I think students start, as the lessons go on and they learn more about the subject, they understand about how the mechanisms work, particularly in that plant or seed or, you know, the structures that are here and the ability to draw it, to sculpt it, to paint it. But, you know, drawing has always been a way of for people to understand, drawing diagrams and so on and so forth. Yeah. And in the process, they understand, they begin to understand something about how this specific specimen operates in its environment, in its habitat. And I think that's gives them a hands-on. If you can't, especially if you cannot be out, for instance, in an old growth forest or in a desert where certain species of lizards and cacti and little burrowing owls live, or in any of the myriad ecologies that are on the planet Earth, to be able to draw from photographs or from living specimens really helps students have some kind of connection.
Yeah, I've found that when I have to look really closely for drawing or painting, I really like to paint, I feel like I appreciate whatever I'm drawing or whomever I'm drawing. Yeah, whether it's a small insect or a plant or any other living thing. Yeah, like you notice more and you also kind of come to appreciate details that you hadn't noticed perhaps just in passing. So that's a great idea.
And just the simple fir cone, you know, how the seed is embedded in the cone and how it is layered and how it is released then by dissecting the specimen. Students can then draw the parts. And when I was doing nature journaling with kids, I would have them dissect these specimens so they can understand, for instance, particularly in seeds, how they're put together and how they function, how they spread themselves.
Yeah, my students love seed dispersal as well.
Yeah, it's a great, great one.
When we spoke the other day, you talked about the similarities between science and art, which you started to talk about a little bit now. I was wondering if you could elaborate on this for the audience.
Well, yeah, in Western culture, the Renaissance was all about that explosion of discovery. You know, they'd had too many centuries of mysticism and magical thinking and conspiracy theories, mistrust of science. I mean, it was illegal to even have a mirror. It's unbelievable the kind of constraints. We have a lot of people today who are wishing to go back and make the Dark Ages great again. But it was the Renaissance that really brokered a whole new way of appreciating facts over feelings and fear. Facts over fear, mainly. And some of the greatest artists that are still celebrated today found their, you know, beginnings then, like Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, he dissected cadavers in order to understand the human anatomy and taught physicians a great deal in the process and did a myriad other kinds of inventions that he drew in extreme detail. And then Galileo learned about, I mean, it really, his analysis of motion was enhanced by Brunelleschi's discovery, I guess the word is, of perspective. And perspective allowed people to start seeing that depictions of nature and of people, of reality, could be almost like looking out the window, or it was so real. And they had been fairly two-dimensional before then, you know. And that enhancement only brought more nuanced and detailed understanding of what the subjects were. So I in Persia, for instance, during the Renaissance, Persian painters were not allowed to do portraiture, especially large portraits, because it was thought that it was an affront to God, you know, to be so presumptive that you could create a likeness of someone. But I think they longed to be able to do that, because painters are always wanting to try new things and to find ways of being more truthful or honest in their depictions. So when artists started doing realistic drawings of plants and of animals, that was unheard of. It's a marvel to me that that people, women particularly, who were medicinal practitioners using plants, were thought to be witches. And that was dispelled in part by artists, the understanding of the plants from dissection and illustration.
Yeah, it seems like both artists and scientists are trying to find truth, but in different ways. So that's kind of an interesting perspective there.
Yeah, and they feed one another.
Yeah. Building off of that, actually, how does art help one get to know plants and animals, as well as develop a sense of place?
When I was teaching either workshops or as an artist in residence or having my own art classes with children, I always felt that it was important for them to develop ways to connect with this place, this land, because we're really in competition constantly now with the digital world of the unreal, the virtual. And the virtual is interesting, but it can be addictive and I think damaging and unmooring to the psyche, especially of children. They need anchoring in reality. And, you know, art can really do that. I know that kids wanted to draw, you know, racing cars and robots and all of these things that are of the imagination. But I would always encourage them to put them in some kind of place. And what animal is watching? And what animals are here? Who lives where? And how do they build their homes? And when do they have their babies? And what do they look like? And how do they feel? And so on and so forth. That, because that is a kind of grounding. And all the functions that art provides in education, I think that is one of the most important.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You've also made an effort to use artwork to help people learn about Native American groups from the area. Can you talk a little about this, as well as some of the ways that Indigenous people interacted with the land?
Well, in my efforts to kind of get kids out of their comfort zone, I mean, you say you want to make kids feel comfortable, but as well, it's important to jog them out of their complacent comfort, you know, so that they can see things anew. So often I would start a lesson, particularly if it were in artist residency capacity, and I only have them for one day, I would introduce the project by talking about this land that the school building is on. There was a time when there was not roads and there were not buildings and there were not houses like we see today, but there were people here and they lived very differently and they lived with the land differently. And introducing words from the Chinook jargon, which is was the trading language between trappers primarily and indigenous people here, and then pioneers and the Indians. Words such as Ilahi, and Ilahi means home, and equally it means land. So land is home, and all of the facets of the land, where the stream is, and the banks of the stream, and the mountains, and the edges of forests, and so on. All of that is Ilahi. And another word that I would often use with them is Yukwa, and Yukwa means here. So to be able to talk about this place using another language, I felt could help kids see maybe the potential for the land as separate from what we now just see as a car driving by. See the car driving by, but you don't see the tree that it passes. And so, using the Native American culture here in the Northwest to talk about the land and the environment was very helpful. And to talk about how the Indians burned the land in order to keep the plants in check from overcrowding one another and crowding out other species. And then when we did field work and we were out in the meadow or forest or wherever we would be, and kids would ask, well, what is this, you know? And they'd show me a plant. And I would say, well, that is an invasive and it was not native here. And they have a better understanding then of what that means. It's non-native. That means that the Europeans brought them. Who were the Europeans? Well, primarily your ancestors. Some of you, you know, are from, your ancestors are from different parts of the world, but whoever was not here for thousands of years is non-native, and they brought with them plants and seeds and animals, and they now live here. You know, a lot of kids didn't understand that. And so to be able to recognize and name plants and animals, plants in particular, because they're easier to acquire when you're out in the field with students. And you can give them the common name and the scientific name. Now, a lot of the native words for plants were not in the Chinook jargon. That was a jargon, and so it was not a complete language. And those words were very specific to tribes, you know, and would vary. But it was fun to be able to point to tarweed, for instance, and say the Kalapuya word for that is salawa, or rattlesnake in Kalapuya, Komema, is quinoswinuk. You know, those kinds of things. So looking at a species or specimen from different points of view give it, I think, enhanced meaning and appreciation.
Yeah, I think the language that we use to refer to living and non-living beings is so important, because you mentioned about using, you know, indigenous words or words that people have used previously. There's in such contrast with, oh, that we see those as natural resources, or we see, you know, something just for humans to use, but a lot of aspects of the land are not necessarily just for humans to use. So it's a neat idea to have just a different perspective, either whether it's, you know, native indigenous perspective or just a different, you know, word within our own language. A different way of thinking about something or someone. Just like with art, we have a different way of observing and noticing different aspects of their being.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. And to elucidate on how the Native Americans here lived without plastic or glass, and that along their pathways there were not found tossed out on the ground, that everything that they used, they made from some tree or grass or rock, wood, and it all belonged to the earth as it came out of the earth.
And then could probably go back to the earth in composting or biodegrading.
Very, very simply. And not lasting conspicuously for thousands of years.
If you could leave our listeners with one lesson that you've learned from your combined experience with art and the environment, what would it be?
I think it would be that the visual arts is a form of storytelling, ultimately. And each artist has, at one time or another, a story that is particular to them that they wish to explore. And telling is exploring, too. So the story that I find that I have been urged over and over to tell is what my experience has been here on this earth, in this place. I've lived on this place you know, I was born here, and then I had time away from this place, but I've come back, and so I've had a very, very long conversation with this particular piece of land, and a way of knowing it that has been so enriching to me. So in my art, I think that I've wanted to show and share what I thought is my version of the grandness and the unparalleled beauty of this natural world. In that way, it's kind of a tribute, you know, to creation. And creation is always demanding a creative response. So it wants to see what my interpretation is. So you're really having a kind of a long dance with what you see and feel around you and how you respond to it. And then you create in response to that. And it feeds in this kind of gratitude. I think that what makes great art then is when someone's version informs and transforms another's perception and understanding of the subject, whatever the subject is. And equally, it can be great when it resonates very deeply with someone. And usually it has to be more than one for it to be great, considered great art. Great art is discovered after its time. Sometimes it's not appreciated in its time. Like Van Gogh.
That's such a beautiful image, thinking about our interactions with the land and with nature as a conversation or a dance. And yeah, I urge our listeners to think about what nature might be saying in response to our actions, kind of that reciprocal back and forth. Well, thank you so much for being on our show today, and hopefully we can have you on again, perhaps.
Thank you. It's been fun, Ryan.
I really enjoyed talking with both Elva and Susan about their experiences with nature journaling and the connections between art and science, and art and appreciation for the natural world. Perhaps you'd like to try nature journaling yourself. You don't need a fancy journal to start out. A simple sketchbook or even a handmade packet will do. You just need something you feel comfortable drawing and writing in. I'd recommend blank pages so you have room to work with. Then take your nature journal outside and try sketching a few things. While editing and finalizing this episode, I stepped outside and pondered what else I might like to share. I paused, looked around, and listened. I noticed birds and wondered what type they were and how they developed the way they did, what their role in the ecosystem was. I heard dogs barking off in the distance and wondered what they were barking at and what they might be saying. I happened to look down and saw a green caterpillar on a leaf and wondered how it could be that there are little green caterpillars out and about in January, being from the East Coast where winters tend to be much colder than they are here. Very quickly I was filled with wonder and lots of wonderings, even within a few steps of my door. One of the great things about nature is that it's accessible. There's life all around us, and as soon as we pause and step away from the computer screen, we can see it. When we take a moment to look closely, we begin to appreciate its intricacies. When we remove the headphones and turn off the TV, we can hear the flow of water over rocks, the varied sounds of animals, the crackling leaves or squishing, slurping mud under our feet. Nature journaling and nature art give us an opportunity to notice and appreciate the world around us. If you have children, you could try nature journaling with them as well. And if drawing and journaling aren't your thing, try a different art form that makes sense for you and your kids. Do you like singing? Come up with songs about plants, animals, and wild places. Perhaps you or your child like to paint? You could illustrate your experience outside. Maybe a poem is more your style, or your kids like building sculptures out of natural materials. The ways you can express your perspective, share your story, and portray your connection to the natural world are as plentiful as the varied art forms that exist and the millions of imaginations that can put those to use. Music? Yes. Dance? Yes. Try something for yourself. And if you have kids, try something with them. Ask them questions about what they notice. Ask them what questions they're wondering too. You never know where their observations might lead, but you can be pretty certain they'll learn something. And the more time we spend closely observing and getting to know and understand various aspects of nature, the more we appreciate and want to protect them. Encourage the exploration. Encourage the questions. Encourage the wonder, and take some time to do some wondering and wandering yourself. Before we wrap up today's episode, I'm going to read a piece entitled The Summer Day by award-winning poet Mary Oliver. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? As always, thank you for listening to another episode of Living Downstream. If you have an idea for a future topic you'd like to hear covered on the show, let me know by emailing ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Again, that's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Come back next week to hear from other local experts about another environmental topic related to Southern Oregon. The intro and outro music for this show are excerpts from the song Forest by Vlad Gluchenko, used under the Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. You can find more information about this song in Living Downstream's information section.